This evening I would invite your attention to 2 Samuel chapter number 21. 2 Samuel chapter 21. Hesitantly, we return to this gruesome scene. If I may put your mind back into the narrative, somewhere around, we are told by some of the better scholarly biblical minds, 30 years or so after the actual event occurred, during the reign of David, a famine falls upon the people of Israel. 3 years of drought and famine. Doubtless, numerous people dying because of such. And it was all a result of Saul's sin. If you will remember, way back even 400 years earlier, Joshua had entered into covenant, the elders of Israel, and Joshua had entered into covenant with the Gibeonites. 400 years later, Saul broke that covenant and began to mercilessly kill the Gibeonites. And as a result of Saul's sin, and that's what it was, God takes covenants very seriously. And as a result of Saul's sin, even as is speculated again, some 30 years after Saul is dead and David is reigning now, God brings judgment upon Israel because of this, because Saul killed people with whom were in covenant with Israel. David inquires of the Lord, why is this famine here? We might want to say, David, is there any reason you waited 3 years to inquire of the Lord? Or had he inquired earlier? And the Lord finally, you know, after a measure of time, did reply, did speak to him. We don't know for certain. But David's response, again, after hearing why the famine had come, was to go to the current day Gibeonites and to ask them what would it take to right this wrong. In fact, the very word used in verse number 3 is, what shall I make atonement? What will make it right? How can we come together with this? Initially, the Gibeonites said, you know, it's not our place. They were a servant people, woodcutters, really water boys that fetched things necessary for the sacrifice and for the king. And anyway, that's just not for us to take the life of an Israelite, and we don't want silver or gold. And then David comes back and says again, no, I'm asking, what's it going to take to right this thing? And I think, and again, I'm looking upwards because one of these days I expect to be in heaven and we'll meet David. And I don't know how much of this I'll remember or any of this that he'll hear. I don't know. But I might have to say, David, I'm wrong. But I'm almost of the mindset, in fact, pretty well, I think, David was so eager to bring an end to 3 years of drought that he was willing to do anything. His poll numbers were down in the single digits. He was not a popular king. You just understand somebody's got to get blamed, and when things don't go good, we point to the White House or they point to the palace. Things weren't going good. 3 years of famine. And so it seems to me that David was eager to do whatever was necessary to make peace. And so here in this scene, the Gibeonites say, here's what will reconcile this. Get us 7 sons of Saul. Well, all of Saul's legitimate children had been killed. But he did have 2 illegitimate children through a concubine named Rizpah. And he had several grandchildren, 5 of whom we find mentioned here, not by name, but 5 grandchildren in this text. And it is the Gibeonites who say, give us these 7 men. We will hang them up. And if you'll notice, as we'll read here in just a moment, before the Lord. In And again, I'll remind you that it's very possible that this was not a hanging on a noose, but rather they were impaled on a sharpened pole, as was sometimes customary. And contrary to Old Testament law, they were left their bodies there for months on end, really from what we would deem to be somewhere around April to October. These seven men, their bodies are left hanging there, whether by the neck on a noose or impaled on a pole. They're hanging there. Did I mention, and I can't remember, the Gibeonites made a point to do this outside the city of Gibeah. It's easy to get Gibeonites and Gibeah and all those together, but let me tell you why that matters. Gibeah was Saul's hometown. So they hung the seven sons, really two sons, five grandsons. They hanged these seven boys, men, maybe some of both, outside of Saul's hometown. So apparently there's some animosity there for the Gibeonites. Some hostility in their hearts because of what Saul had done. I struggle with the idea they did this, quote, before the Lord, but the very fact that they did it where they did it shows some spite, at least in how I look at it. And so we're now going to come back, as uncomfortable as it is, to that scene of these seven men hanging outside the city or village of Gibeah. And I want you to see a woman named Rizpah. And tonight we'll notice Rizpah upon the rocks. Having that background in front of us, notice with me verse 8 through verse 14. 2 Samuel 21, 8. But the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth. And again, I remind you, that's a different Mephibosheth. Saul had a son by this concubine Rizpah named Mephibosheth, and he had a grandson through Jonathan named Mephibosheth. So it's not the same one as the cripple to whom David had shown kindness. You can go back up to the previous verse to see that. And, verse 8, and the five sons of Michael, the daughter of Saul. So these are five grandsons of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Mahalothite. And he delivered them. This is David's actions. Having sent his men to gather these men and to bring them to the Gibeonites, these seven guys, don't lose it. There's seven men just going about life, whether they're young or old, we don't know. It's just purely speculative. Whether some were 50 and some were 15, possibly. We just don't know. There's seven men going about life, and the king's soldiers arrive and say, this is it for you. Okay? And he, that is David, and he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the hill before the Lord. And they fell, all seven together, and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days of the beginning of barley harvest, which would again be on our calendar somewhere around April. And as we continue to read the narrative, we're going to see that it's not until the latter rains come in Jewish language, that's somewhere around October, the fall rains. And Rizpah, verse 10, and Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock from the beginning of harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beast of the field by night. And it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, which had stolen them from the street of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them, when the Philistines had slain Saul in Gilboa. And he brought up from thence the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, and they were gathered I'm sorry, and they gathered the bones of them that were hanged, those seven men, and the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son, buried they in the country of Benjamin and Zelah, in the sepulcher of Kish his father, and they performed all that the king commanded. And notice this last line of this verse. And after that, God was entreated for the land. So what are we to make of that last little thought? After that, God ended the famine and brought rains to Israel. So again, as I've given you this brief history of what is behind us, 3 years of drought, the death of these Gibeonites, I'm sorry, the death of these seven men at the hands of the Gibeonites, let me just bring your mind back that it is here again at this point where I confessed to you last week and continue to say that I'm just not 100% sure what to think of this narrative. Either David was right by handing over the sons and grandsons of Saul, as some commentators would say, or David wrongly handed them over by consulting the Gibeonites rather than God as to how atonement could be made. While I'm not angry with someone who would look at this differently or interpret it or exegete it differently than what I do, I tend to think that David was so eager to bring an end to 3 years of famine that he was willing to do pretty much anything, up to and including allowing seven, and I'm going to use air quotes, innocent men to be killed and hung. Was David right? Is it true that innocent blood had been shed by Saul? Yes. Is it true that sometimes, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, is it true that sometimes children do have to suffer the consequences of their parents' actions? Yeah, that's true. And it is. But that's not the way it should be. Again, I give you this from last week, Deuteronomy 24:16 states that children shall not be put to death for the sins of their fathers. So I tend to think that David was in an error, that he was wrong for consulting the Gibeonites on how to make atonement rather than consulting God how to make an atonement for this. If he did, it's not included. But regardless of how you interpret this, or regardless of how you exegete this narrative, this much is certain, and this is where we closed last week. Even in all of this brutality, in all of this ugliness, we see an inspired illustration of the gospel. The innocent atoning for the guilty. Those seven men who had not committed the sin of their father, yet they had to pay the penalty of the sin of their father. Which certainly points our minds to Calvary, as Jesus also was hung, not by the neck, not impaled upon a pole, but nailed to a cross, hung between heaven and earth, as the Bible says, there to be made sin for us. He who knew no sin became our atonement. God poured his wrath out on his son, not because of his sin, but because of ours. And so while this is a gruesome sight, it is also an inspired illustration of the sacrificial, substitutionary death of Jesus on the cross. See, through your mind's eye, see those seven bodies hanging lifelessly from a pole. And then look to Calvary. And see God's Son suffering and bloody as He hung upon a pole to make atonement, not for what He had done, but for what we had done. Different, however, is this. Jesus was truly innocent. Now these seven men, I used the term a minute ago, they were innocent. They weren't sinless. But there's nothing for us to imply that they were had a hand in what Saul had done, their father or grandfather. Probably the grandchildren of Saul didn't have any idea what their grandfather had done. Maybe even never even knew him. But nonetheless, these men, though were innocent of those charges and had to pay the penalty, Jesus was truly innocent. He was truly sinless. Saul's family were not guilty of murdering Gibeonites, but they were still sinners. Certainly not saying I condone the action that was taken upon them, but they were not sinless like Jesus. And then the body of Jesus was taken down off of that cross, and he was resurrected after 3 days. The bodies of these men that we're reading about, Saul's family, remained hung or impaled for some 6 months or so. Which brings us now to Rizpah. Rizpah upon the rocks. Let me remind you, Rizpah was a concubine of Saul. As politely as I can say it, those with kingly authority, men would indulge in sinful acts of the flesh, and young ladies would be groomed. Attractive young ladies would be groomed from a very young age to be nothing. I'm trying to say it very politely, to delight the pleasures of a sinful man, to please the king and the bedroom. That's what they were for. Whether they wanted it or not, that didn't matter. They didn't have a choice in the option. They were concubines of the king. And Rizpah was a concubine of Saul. And so this would have been, you know, David never considered Saul an enemy, but Saul certainly considered David an enemy. But now she had been removed from her place in the palace or whatever the city was as a concubine. And she is now outliving her life with her and her 2 illegitimate sons, Armoni and Mephibosheth. But in this passage, outside the city of Gibeah, where those 7 bloody bodies are hanging, you see a mother's love. A mother's love. As comfortable, I'm sorry, as uncomfortable as it is, I want us to visit that gruesome sight in our minds. I want us to see the emaciated bodies of these 7 individuals who brutally died. And I want you to witness with me this evening a woman who had been cast aside from the palace, mistreated by men, watched her own 2 sons being drug away, and now suffers the grotesque job of keeping vigil over the lifeless bodies of her 2 sons and 5 nephews. This is perhaps one of the most hideous events and repugnant stories in the Bible. Would you notice what Rizpah has done? Verse 10, "And Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock, somewhere nearby those 7 bodies, from the beginning of harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven." Again, that makes reference to studied or whatever you want to make reference to the fall rain. "Water drops upon them out of heaven and suffered," notice the close of verse 10, "neither the birds of the air to rest upon them to pick at the flesh of those dead bodies of her family, nor the beasts of the field by night to come and rip apart their bodies." She spread a little sackcloth, a little rough blanket out on a rock to keep a gruesome vigil over the bodies of these boys, to protect her family. Probably Rizpah sets up a little makeshift tent close by, and to keep the vultures away during the day, and the jackals at night. She keeps constant care and watch over that hideous scene. Day after day. Night after night. Envision Rizpah with a stick in her hand. Perhaps some ancient broom or broom handle, swinging and swatting away the buzzards and the crows. See her there with a torch in her hand in the pitch blackness at night, shouting and chewing away the coyotes and the jackals that would tear apart the bodies of those boys. How painful it must have been as the smell of rotting flesh filled her nostrils during those hot summer months. Now, I'm giving you the cleaned up version. I spent this week reading what happens to a human body that is left out in the elements in the heat. This is her two sons. How horrible it must have been to watch their bodies bloat and decay, yet tirelessly and faithfully, she served as a brave sentinel, looking over the family that she loved. It would be impossible to put into words what this woman and many others like her have been forced to endure. Much at the hands of fallen men, whether erring kings, jealous, powerful men, bitter, angry foes, or abusive husbands, or filthy fathers. She had been Saul's concubine. She gave birth to what was considered illegitimate children, but she obviously loved them with all of her heart. And Saul had been removed from his kingship. She had been removed from her role, from her place, and was now dependent on her sons. In that ancient custom, she would have been fully dependent on her sons to provide her sustenance and her need. Further yet, Rizpah, if you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 3, though we cannot say again definitively, the narrative seems to imply, or at least strongly lean our thoughts and minds to the fact that she had been sexually assaulted by Abner, Saul's uncle, in his power grab for the throne. Concubine, sexually assaulted, and now after humiliation, abuse and rejection, she watches helplessly as her two sons were killed, hung upon a pole, impaled upon a pole, five nephews killed, even though they'd done nothing wrong. As I read this week and thought about Rizpah's faithfulness, her love for her sons, and her unyielding devotion to them, I couldn't help but think about Mary. I couldn't help but think about Mary. She had suffered a lot of criticism. Rumors were spread. False accusations had been made about her. Yet she gave birth to the Son of God, what some consider to be an illegitimate child. But can you see Mary, like Rizpah, standing by the body of her child? Can you see Mary standing by the cross, helplessly watching as her son was brutally killed for the sins of others? Thankfully, though, Mary did not have to endure the indignity the awful ugliness of seeing her son hang for days or for weeks, but instead on that day of crucifixion, Jesus was taken down, his body laid in a tomb, but praise God, he rose again. His body didn't stay there. A mother's love. If you see nothing else from Mary, and I'm convinced now, how gruesome, how hard must it have been for Mary, the mother of Jesus, to watch? How hard it must have been for Rizpah to endure months of what she had to endure. And I'm convinced that a mother's love is the greatest love on the planet, second only to the love that God has for us. If Rizpah was willing to sacrifice so much for the dead bodies of her sons and her family, Mom, what are you willing to do for the souls of your children and your family? Look at what she did. Chasing away the fowls of the air at day and the beast at night. Tirelessly looking after this gruesome scene of her sons and nephews. If she is so committed to protecting their dead bodies, how much more should we as parents be willing to give ourselves for the living souls of our children? Mom, Grandma, Dad, Grandpa, will you stand vigil like Rizpah? Not over the lifeless bodies, but over the souls of your children? Will you sacrifice sleep and comfort in order to pray for them? Will you endure long, hot days and cold nights? Afraid, perhaps even alone if you must? Not to drag your kids from one event to another, but to pour Christ into their hearts and in their minds. See in Rizpah a godly example of motherhood and devotion and love and faithfulness. A lady that I know, Pat knows, we watched for several years. She was a single mom. Husband left her with two small children. And week after week after week, all alone, she'd get those kids up, get them to school, go to work, come home. You know where she was every Wednesday night? At Bible study. You know where she was every Sunday morning and Sunday night? She was at church. Yes, she went to the ball field. She went to piano recitals, all of those things. But her concern was to stand vigil over the soul of her children. What are we willing to sacrifice like Rizpah for the souls of our children? Friends, there are vultures and there are predators after our young people. There are countless dangers lurking in the darkness, waiting for the opportunity to lunge and tear them to pieces. Mom, Grandma, Dad, Granddad, will you keep a constant vigil like Rizpah over the lives and souls of your little ones? Are you willing to sacrifice sleep and even your own personal safety to fight off the wolves that would rip your kids apart? I cannot say definitively the condition of Rizpah's soul, but she seems as one who had a heart devoted to loving Yahweh, the one true living God. She certainly displayed faithfulness devotion, and love. And there's a reason why the author included this story in the narrative for us. Not just an interesting add-on, a tag-on to the narrative, but to make known the impact that one person, even a woman in a culture that looked down on women, the impact that one person could have. Look at verse 11 with me. And it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done. How many of her friends said, "Rizpah, come home. We'll take care of them. You've done all you can for them, boy." How many of her friends and family thought she's lost her mind? She's out there week after week after week. There's nothing she could do now. But I want you to notice, verse 11 says, the king took notice. The king got word of what Rizpah had done, and it forced him into action. Mom, never discount the power that you have as a mother to change the community around you. What she did, and you get into the narrative, and I don't want you too far ahead of where I am, but what she did pushed David into action. It's as if he was mindlessly going about the affairs of ruling a nation, not thinking about them seven lives he handed over to the Gibeonites 6 months earlier. But then he catches word about the faithfulness of this woman that a lot of people probably just thought were crazy. David then, and I'm going to just give you the shorter end of it, and David then does what he should have done a long time ago, and that is he goes to Jabesh Gilead, and he gets the bones of Saul, King Saul, and of Jonathan, and probably the two other boys, but they're hardly ever mentioned. If you will remember, when the Philistines slew Saul and Jonathan, they hung their bodies up on the wall of the city, defaming them, mocking and ridiculing, and there were some faithful men of Jabesh Gilead who fought to that Philistine city and took the bodies down and buried them. And they've not received a proper royal funeral yet. And so Rizpah's actions prompt David to going to Jabesh Gilead and getting the bones of Saul and Jonathan, and again, probably his two other boys that were killed, along with, the close of verse 13, the bones of those that were hanged. Not the bodies even at this point, the bones of those that were hanged. And he takes them and gives them a proper burial. An appropriate funeral. It is right and good to respect those who are in authority. And this is what David should have done 30 years earlier, but he hadn't when he assumed the role of the king. The king took notice of her devotion, her sacrifice, and it moved him into action. It motivated him to honor those dead. David recovers those bodies, gives them a proper funeral. Listen, the world might think you crazy because you keep midnight prayer vigil over your children. Let them think what they want to think. The world might think you crazy because you refuse to sacrifice this, this, and this. People might think you're a little religious nut because you insist that church is more important than what they're going on at the ball field. That worship is more important than what's going on at the Ag Center. That worship and serving Christ and pouring biblical truth into my children, that's more important than what they've got going on at the fairgrounds. Or whatever, you feel it is. The world might think you're a little bit nutty, a little religious zealot. But that's all right. You stand vigil over the souls of your children. Don't discount the importance of your actions. David's actions in response to, I think, to what Rizpah had done. David's actions are to get those bodies, give them a proper burial, and at the close of verse 14, and after that, God was intrigued. Perhaps there had been a sprinkle or two on those bodies, and that's when Rizpah brought them down or whatever, but we notice that it wasn't until David did what was right that he brought an end to the famine. And you can read in that, and I don't think you're reading too much into that, that it was the actions of Rizpah, faithfulness, devotion, and commitment that prompted David into action, which brought an end to the famine. Hear me when I say, don't discount, don't think too little of what you can accomplish through devotion, love, faithfulness, and commitment to Christ. It must have pained her greatly to stand there week after week, month after month, but it was all worth it when she saw her boy buried. Sadly, just a couple more thoughts. Sadly, sometimes children have to suffer because of their parents. Sometimes children have to endure awful things because of a generation before them. Sometimes moms have to bury their children. Rizpah. But through it all, God is faithful. God is faithful. We're going to move forward next week into the last half of this chapter. I hope you've been benefited and blessed by this. And I suppose I'm going to continue to wonder if I have handled this text properly, if I falsely accused David or not, if I've handled it well. But look at Rizpah upon the rock as a wonderful example of a mother's love and devotion, and what a difference that she made and the difference that you can make. Thank you for walking with me through that ugly scene. But all those things were written for our admonition. That's what the New Testament tells us. And we can learn and grow.